This edition of Culture with Robert Bounds was first broadcast on the 25th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 76th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Alrighty, today we've got a show that is the essence of balance, the epitome of covering all the bases, a well-oiled machine that has under its umbrella live music, a report from an international art fair, a dose of media salts, a gallery tour with an enlightening artist, and a chat about the movers, shakers, fiddlers and drummers from the world's premier musical gathering. Now the dust has settled on this year's South by Southwest Music Conference, we'll be asking who the breakout act were, and we'll take a road trip from Toronto to Austin with one new band who are trying to get noticed there.
We're standing in a Wendy's parking lot. We've been in the van for what, 16 hours?
About that. Yeah.
And now there's no show.
There's plenty more shows where that one came from.
We'll be joining a deeply, and I mean this in the proper sense of the much maligned word, groovy Midori House session and interview with soul legend Cody Chesnutt.
You find a deeper way to communicate the songs, you know, the more you play them out live, and you know, you see people's reaction and how those songs really find people where they live.
And we'll be exploring artist Ian Whittlesey's wonderfully imaginary universe. He's a man with a plan to make art theory, art practice. His new show at London's Marlborough Contemporary Gallery promises to make you disappear.
It's not a question of dematerializing or becoming incorporeal. You're still in the room, you just are unobservable.
Plus, we'll take the temperature of Brazil's independent publishing scene and hear how the ever-impressive Art Dubai went down this year. Marissa Katz is on that case. That well-tended garden of artistic blooms is all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First up then, as ever, is this week's Midori House session, and a rather special one at that. Cody Chesnutt is a soul man, a blues guy, a bit of an American legend, and a man who's come back from a 10-year break with a wonderful new record called Landing on 100. He might just be the coolest man we've had in the studio, although John Cale might like to fight him for that title. Cody came in armed with just a guitar for a stripped-down soulful vibe. Here he is with Till I Met Thee.
Search of my growth. Oh, yeah. Found what I needed. Nothing more. Just what I needed, yeah. The pure heart of a baby. And I came to full and whole. Ooh, I was a dead man. Dead man, I was asleep, knocked out for a minute. I was a stranger in a foreign land. Whoa, till I met thee, Lord. And I wanna say it again, say, I was a dead man, I was asleep. Lord knows I was a stranger in a foreign land. Oh, till I met thee. Second verse. I felt the cold when I was bound for the country road that day. And I was burdened down. Who would help me, Lord? I said I did not know, I did not know that I felt your healing hand all on me, Lord. I felt your healing hand, yeah. now all that would break me, I now crush to the soul glory. I was a dead, dead, dead man. I was asleep. I was a stranger in foreign land. Said I was a stranger in foreign land. I was walking in darkness with a no sense of direction. Then you came and made a way for me to see all of my afflictions. Said I was a stranger in a danger. I was walking darkness with a no sense of direction. Then you came and made a way for me to see all of my afflictions. I walk in darkness with a no sense of direction. Then you came and made a way for me to see that I was going the other way in a man-made maze. And you came and made a way for me to see all of my afflictions. I walk in darkness with a no sense of a direction. Yeah. Till I met thee, Lord, yeah.
Thank you, Manipal.
That was Cody Chesnut, former Miss Midori House session performer for us here with Till I Met Thee. More from him later on in the show. This is Culture on Monocle 24, where we move now from one musical spectacle to another. Every March, thousands of musicians from around the world travel to Austin, Texas for South by Southwest, which wrapped up just over a week ago. Last year, we dispatched Marcellus by plane for Culture, but this year she decided to take a slightly different route, travelling on the road with a new band, trying to get themselves noticed at the industry showcase. Toronto band Absolutely Free formed out of the ashes of Day, Month, Year just over a year ago. They travelled to Austin to play six shows at their first South by Southwest West in this new incarnation. Every band playing the festival is allowed one official showcase, but most bands will also play sometimes up to 10 unofficial shows over the week of the festival. It's a hectic experience, but the rewards have the potential to make a young band's career. Driving from Toronto to Austin is no big deal for these guys. They've travelled to all 48 continental states on previous tours, but it was one of the longest drives Mar had done in quite a while. Here is her road trip with Absolutely Free.
We leave Toronto at the crack of dawn and drive for 12 hours to Evansville, Indiana, where the band are playing a house show. There are five of us, drums, amps, sleeping bags, luggage, and instruments all squished into a minivan like Tetris pieces. The band booked this show to break up the drive and get some sleep on the 30-hour trip down to Austin. House owner and promoter Brett Seiler.
Oh yeah, we had a potluck tonight because it was kind of a strange one because it was like people were mostly brought junk food and stuff, and like one or two people actually made a dish, but yeah, it was fun. I know there's a smaller crowd, but I was able to get them a decent amount of money, $72. So
$72 richer and well rested in Indiana, we head on to Austin the next day. Band members Mike Claxton and Jordan Holmes.
We are in a car. We've been in this car for 14 hours. We are headed to Austin. We have 3 hours to go. My rear end is numb.
Jordan, where are you guys playing when we get to Austin?
We're playing at my favorite establishment. We're playing in the parking lot of a Wendy's restaurant. It's going to be amazing.
How was the show in Evansville last night?
It was fun. It was a good time.
I don't know, my favorite part of the night was when we got to eat a lot of donuts that were brought specifically for us because we're Canadian for some reason. And apparently there's a stereotype that people in Canada always smile and offer each other donuts.
After driving through six states, we finally arrive at the South by South Wendy's parking lot to find no bands, no stage, only Wendy's customers eating French fries.
A text from the promoter arrives. Band member Matt King.
Sorry, I forgot to text y'all. Generator broke and cops freaked. Maybe we can fill you in later spot this weekend. I'll let you know. Sorry, dudes.
So,
wah, wah.
We're standing in a Wendy's parking lot. We've been in the van for what, 16 hours?
How about that?
Yeah. And now there's no show.
That's okay. Funny. There's plenty more shows where that one came from. This is just the beginning.
Okay, well, what should we do?
We all go home for some much-needed sleep and showers. Fast forward 2 days. It's day 3 of South by Southwest. We are currently at a venue called The Owl in East Austin, not the nicest neighborhood in the world. How many shows have you guys played so far?
I think we've played 3 shows so far.
Every night, hundreds of bands are playing all over the city, official and unofficial shows, simultaneously. I asked the band what they hope to achieve out of the unofficial shows.
We find that when we're playing in venues kind of outside the downtown core, we're playing to local people, and that's definitely has a residual effect on, like, when we return on a tour, there's, like, you know, little pockets of people from each little subsect that we play in this guy's backyard, that guy's house, you know, and then they all come out to our shows. So that's, like, I guess the benefit of playing the alternate shows, but then I guess playing the shows downtown, when we go downtown, it's all business, baby.
After playing 4 unofficial shows and having 2 shows canceled, it's finally time for the band's official showcase at Valhalla, a venue in the heart of Austin's downtown on Red River Street. Red River, along with 6th Street, is a mecca of venues and clubs. Every other building and every street corner has a band performing. The streets are blocked from traffic and the pavement is filled with music fans, drunk people, and bicycle taxis. Valhalla is a dingy bar that seems like it would normally have bad drink specials and country music. But this is South by Southwest, and it's the final Saturday night of the festival. Absolutely Free is the last band playing at 1 a.m. It's One Big Silence, the band's record label showcase. Tonight, the bill is made up of fellow Torontonians, Rituals, Tassiomancy, and Moon King.
Thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks for spending your last show at South by Southwest.
I recognize quite a few people in the crowd tonight from back home, but there are a few unknown faces as well. Mark from Wales.
That was definitely my favorite gig of South by Southwest by miles. I'm in a band called Islet from Wales.
How many shows have you done here?
We've done 2, but we've watched about a million.
Is it worth it traveling all this way?
I think it is. It's good to meet new people and reminding yourself that about a million other bands exist as well is always quite useful. And watching them and learning and enjoying music.
We leave Sunday morning to drive back to Toronto. Getting closer to home, band drummer Moshe Rosenberg comments on the final show.
I was pretty anxious beforehand because we had our amplifier was blown, and so we thought we would have to plug the guitar like directly into the board, which would have made it sound like a toy. But everything ended up working and the crowd really filled in like last minute, like just as we were starting. And I really felt the love because there were so many familiar faces in the crowd. And it was really nice that it was our last show too, because it was definitely by far the best one. Having ended on a positive note fueled us for this 30-hour drive.
I asked Moshe if he thinks the trip has benefited the band.
We are still a really new band, and we're still forming first impressions. So it's kind of open. Basically, anything that comes of it is going to be a good thing, and so much can come of it because we're sort of like a blank canvas at this point, like really new band, you know, more or less doing everything on our own or with help of friends. So even if anything comes of it, that will be good enough for us.
As we cross back into Canada, the band check their email. A few messages are already coming in from people they met.
one from a European promoter. A good sign at the end of a long drive. For Monocle on the Road, I'm Mars Sellers.
That was UFO by Absolutely Free, ending that report from Mars Sellers. Well, one man who may well have been in the crowds at one of those gigs was Crispin Parry, founder of British Underground, a company that promotes British music around the world. We were keen to get a flavour of this year's breakout acts who caught the attention of the music industry, so we invited Crispin into Midori House, fresh off the plane from Austin, to talk us through how it went and what caught his eye and ear.
Well, the first band is a band from New Orleans called Hooray for the Riff Raff. And this is a singer-songwriter. She's comes out of that tradition of rail riding in the States. So she picked up her bags in New York and she went in a train carriage down to New Orleans, got off the train there, set up shop. And she's now become a very, very, I guess, established New Orleans songwriter. Her name is Alinda Lisa Gurr, and she has a sort of a group of exchanging musicians who become Hooray for the Riff Raff. But you could see this year she played out at Willie Nelson's Ranch. She played out much bigger shows, so she's probably going to be a breakout artist. And she played in a shack on the east side of town. So we went over there at 4 p.m. She played that show. She'll do 5 or 6 shows across the event, varying from in the convention centre in a very formal setting to this rather sort of sitting on the stoop with the fiddle player playing that stuff. So this is a good way to kind of understand there's lots of different elements, and this is the stoop side element of South by Southwest.
Well, my baby, she's my like a baby, little black star. She's baby, just like her daddy, baby, way yonder far. She's baby, just like her daddy.
We're discussing South by Southwest. That was one of our guest picks, Crispin. That was Hooray for the Riff Raff. That's beautiful.
Yeah, and just imagine with the local beer is called Lone Star. The sun is going down. Everyone's in a great mood, and that's the music that's playing out there. So really good.
That is something you want to bottle, literally, isn't
it? Yeah, I'll try and do that next time. I'll bring it back to you.
And you describe that as the stoop side of South by Southwest.
Yeah.
Well, let's paint a picture. Can you paint us a picture, maybe, of how you saw the next artist you're going to play?
Okay. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about trends in that respect. I mean, at South by Southwest, this huge festival within a festival within a festival, there are now brands who are leading the dance in many ways. Some of them would be Spotify, who are natural fits, but also Doritos, Taco Bell, MySpace, Dr. Martens. All of these guys are there kind of hosting these music shows and getting everyone to blog and just making sure that their brands are in the mix of this big festival. So the next artist is a hip-hop artist called Angel Hayes, and she played on the Pandora stage. What's interesting is there's rumours that she wasn't going to turn up at all, but she played on that stage, and she'll move very quickly from that one to the next one and the next one. But this is it was a great show. I mean, this would have been in a car park that they built a huge festival stage in. So that's another side of it. Much more corporate, lots of brands. The stage wasn't a stoop. This is a properly built industrial festival stage, and she did 8 songs there.
Criminal general, take shots but never subliminal. Don't stop, ever continue. We're running and running, but never in the intervals. Can't be a summit. The shit that I'm gonna do, y'all niggas rump the shit that I'm
Angel Hayes there. Much tipped, hotly tipped by all sorts of polls and da 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 da. And obviously now a Twitter fight with Azalea Banks. I think I'm right in thinking.
Yeah.
Is no such thing as bad PR. What time of day did you see her? That's kind of that feels like a kind of like early evening thing.
That was at probably about 5:10. In the evening.
That's better, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of the time and day for
yeah, I guess that sort of stuff goes out the window, though. I mean, let's say the music starts at 12 noon and runs. I mean, there's a strict licensing and stuff there. You'd be surprised, actually, the health and safety that they put behind all of this, which is why that chaos is kept in check. But
yeah.
It starts at 12, it finishes at 2. So you will get to see the most hardcore hip-hop at 12 o'clock, and you might get to see the most laid-back summer sounds at midnight or 1 o'clock. Because people are moving around so much and everyone's doing more than one show, you lose track of all of that stuff, really. I mean, I like that idea of stumbling across something. I think that's really important. The best things I've ever found there have always been by a happy accident. So that, yes, you can plan as much as you like. I mean, surely with the convention schedule, you're going to have to do that. But actually, in the evening, I like a little bit of mixing it up.
Cool. Well, let's hear Matt DiMarco, and then we'll chat about him at the end.
Oh, life moves this slowly.
That's rather lovely. That was Mac DiMarco. Crispin, tell us about him. He sounds like a bit like he might be the new Robert Wyatt or something. It sounds
He's
all over the place and lovely.
He's quite wild. I mean, he's sort of halfway between Kurt Cobain and Brian Adams, really. That's his. That's his territory.
Maybe that was a chilled bit of a raucous song.
But what he is, I think, I always look for things that are world class. I think that's the thing, something that's going to break out. I mean, he's from Montreal. He's already seems to have got a little headway at South by Southwest. He's coming over here in May. Just an extraordinary character. I mean, an amazing performer. He looks like a slacker. I mean, he's got a real slacker's air about him. He's got slacker hair, slacker face. He's got the whole thing
slacker
going.
Slacker face.
Yeah. And his performance is that, but he's
got a bit of a Ryan Adams thing going on there. Yeah.
But the thing that he gets right is a superb band, superb musician, and the songs are phenomenal. But so what looks like a very sort of loose performance is something that's brilliantly choreographed and immediately takes you in.
We're going to squeeze in one more song because I think that's what we kind of want to be getting the vibe of. What have you saved for last, Crispin?
Well, this is, I mean, just to give you an idea of the variety of what goes on, I did sort of say to someone, I want to see some gospel at South by Southwest. And I have some good people who give me tips from all over America. And then my friend Gabe Soraya from New York said, you've got to go and see the Como Mamas. And this was on the Daptone showcase. And so I went down pretty much sort of on my own, left the group behind and went down to see this. And this was an amazing thing. So it's three gospel singers from Como, Mississippi.
Now let us all go back to that old
holy mama.
Now let us all
go back
to that old
holy mama.
Now let us all
go back
to that.
I'm feeling considerably closer to God, Crispin. That's proper hairs on the back of your neck stuff. That's lovely. Where did you see the Como Mamas?
So this was in
The Como Mamas
were in the Moody Theatre. So this is kind of like most of the venues are fairly shabby, or that's the stoop kind of thing. This was in a proper arts theatre at one end of town, part of a Daptones review. So the next thing you got was other sort of soul artists building into a sort of, I can't remember who the headline was, but it's part of their, you do get these reviews. So Dave Grohl did his Sound City review. Right. I went to see that. So that kind of label showcase or idea showcase is a big thing there. So that I saw that one in the Moody Theatre.
That was Crispin Parry, founder of British Underground, talking us through some of the big hits from South by Southwest. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where next we're headed to Dubai. Stay tuned.
From the historic centre of pencil making to the world's biggest trade fair, Monocle Films profiles a pioneering German stationery brand taking the pencil into the 21st century.
It is more or less in our genes to make pencils. And behind this is not only the region of Nuremberg, it's also the German type of engineering, of really digging deep into things, trying to understand things and to create novelties from this deep understanding of how things are made.
Sharpening Up with Stettler, in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where from Austin we're headed now to the Middle East. While a handful of capitals across the Arab world seesaw between revolutions and referendums, heart-shaped Dubai has steadfastly clung to its reputation as a hassle-free hub where people the world over come to make a mark and watch their ambition take flight. And it isn't just the bankers or real estate developers who've been lured to try their luck. It's also artists, curators and gallerists. Nowhere is that drive more evident than during the annual Art Dubai Fair. Now in its seventh year, the fair has expanded to feature 75 galleries from 30 different countries, making it one of the most international art fairs in the world. We heard from the fair's director, Antonia Carver, last week on Culture, but reporter Marissa Mazria-Katz travelled to Dubai to see the event itself and meet Antonia last week, and she sent us this report.
Crisp white dish dashes mix with the clicking of stiletto heels on the opening night of Art Dubai. Here, pert gallerists from emerging art spaces in Africa mix with stalwarts from Beirut and London. The maze of white walls here is covered with any kind of art imaginable, including photographs of illuminated construction cranes hovering over Mecca's holiest site, the Kaaba, and paintings covered in reverse glass hexagons inspired by mosques in Iran. Over the years, the fair has extended its reach to Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, making it a do-not-miss destination for not only those who are serious about collecting, but also for those who want exposure to art made beyond the confines of traditional art world hubs like Paris and New York. Antonia Carver is the fair's director.
The proliferation of cultural centers in the East has really made Art Dubai something of a hub. Dubai, the city, and also the fair. So not only has the roster of galleries grown, but it's become incredibly global. And for our size of fair, we're perhaps the most globalized fair in the world today. But we also have a huge not-for-profit program, over 14 commissions, over 45 artists involved in our projects, and the Global Art Forum, which is a six-day conference taking place across two cities, again with around 45 participants. And these are just some of the not-for-profit programs we do. So it's a fair that has a commercial edge through the galleries, but also this vast non-commercial programming as well. And we think that really reflects the nature of the city which we're in, and it also kind of makes us a very unique kind of meeting point.
But as Art Dubai expands, the Middle Eastern Art Fair label may no longer be the only one that applies. A specially curated section of the fair, called The Marker, features a handful of galleries from West African countries, including Ghana, Mali, Nigeria, and Senegal. BC Silva, who is the Lagos-based director of the Center for Contemporary Art and curator of The Marker, explains why it's so important these galleries are here in Dubai.
I think it's about extending and presenting the work of Malian or Senegalese or Nigerian artists to a new audience. There has been very few interaction between the Middle East and Africa south of the Sahara. This is the first time all the artists that are exhibiting in Dubai or in the Middle East. And I think that, you know, hopefully this will generate interest, it will generate collaborations, exchange, dialogue. And I know that very few people in the Middle East know about contemporary artistic practice from the continent. So this is an opportunity for both of us to learn about each other, for the artists from Africa to see the work that's been made here, and for artists here to see what's being done in Africa. Because a lot of the times they think nothing much is happening, or that the art is traditional. For me, I'm totally interested in the Global South. The Global South forms two-thirds of the majority of the world's population, and we haven't interacted with them. Due to colonial and historical ties, we've interacted more with Europe and with America. So we have a whole geographical regions that have not been explored, that don't know much about African art. And I think, you know, coming to Dubai is the first step towards engaging with these communities and with new audiences.
The tapestry of unrest and all-out war touching countries across the region has hit a handful of the artists represented in the fair hard. Hisham Samawi runs the Dubai arm of the Ayam Gallery, which opened its first branch in Damascus in 2006.
About 2 years ago, when the revolution started in Syria, we recognized that it was a slippery slope, and you know, for the benefit of our artists and for our program and everything, that we had to make some tough decisions, which was to try to get our artists and our employees and the art out of Damascus. So we kind of started shipping things from there, moving things here. So the gallery stopped doing exhibitions, but a lot of our artists were living there, and a lot of them had studios there, and it was no longer safe for them to come. So we decided there was actually more value in us turning the gallery into artist studios and a refuge for them, so they could move and actually continue to work. But for them, since a good chunk of them were in Syria at the time, we wanted to get them out of harm's way, and the first place for that was in Damascus. And so we did that. Over the course of 2 years, we moved more than 2,000 artworks from Damascus to Dubai. We relocated a bunch of our employees, their families. It would have been a tragedy to have all this amazing art kind of trapped there with what's happening now.
The stability offered here pushed Samawi to make Dubai the location for Ayam Gallery's main headquarters and to open a second space in the city's financial district.
So it was, you know, when we were looking for the next place to move our gallery, I mean, as far as the operations, I mean, Dubai was a no-brainer. I was already here at the time. It's a very open society. It's very easy to kind of do things, the logistics, everything. It makes sense to make this the hub, especially with, you know, the two major art fairs being here and our two galleries being here. It made sense for us to have kind of the art and everything here. And it was, you know, relatively easy initially to bring them over here and to get them visas and stuff like that. So it's been, you know, it's been a savior for us, actually.
A savior indeed. 2 days into the fair, Samawi and his team sold pretty much everything on the walls. They just finished stringing up an entirely new selection of pieces in hopes they can do it all over again before the fair closes. It's a familiar story here in Dubai, not to be confused, though, with the fair's earliest days, when people snatched up pieces because an artist sold well at an auction. Today's buyers are more contemplative, less frenzied about their choices. But for many gallerists, this is a good thing. As they see it, many new collections that are being built, particularly in this region, are for real, not for show. And with the tremendous groundwork being laid by Art Dubai, it's likely they'll keep on growing. For Monocle in Dubai, I'm Marissa Mazria-Katz.
Thank you, Marissa. And for those just joining us, you're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Still to come in part two, we'll enjoy some more of that stunning session from cool cat Cody Chestnut, and I'll have a chat with the man himself. Then I'll do my best to disappear with conceptual artist Ian Whittlesey, and we'll hear how the independent publishing scene is doing in Brazil. Lot of fun, right? So before I try and vanish into the ether, some more of this week's Midori House session. This is Cody Chestnut with No Turning Back.
I used to smoke crack back in the day. I used to gamble, rent money and lose. I used to dog the nice ladies, used to swindle friends, but now I'm teaching kids in Sunday school, and I'm not turning back. No turning back. No turning back. No turning back to little time now. No turning back. One, two, three. No one could sell a lie quicker than I. No one could shift the blame better than me. I used to walk out on my family within, intent to sin, rejecting all accountability. Lord, I'm not turning back. No turning back. Yeah, nah. No turning back. No turning back to a little time. No turning back. Listen here, I say I'm not turning. I'm not turning. I'm not turning. I'm not turning back. I'm not turning. I'm not turning. I'm not turning. I'm not turning back, no turning back. No turning back. No turning back to little time. No turning back.
Not done yet.
I used to smoke crack back in the day. I used to gamble, rent money and lose. was one. I used to dog the nice ladies, used to swindle our friends. Now I'm teaching them in Sunday school. No turning back. No turning back.
There we go.
Beautiful stuff, right? And in tried and tested Midori House session style, Cody swung by the studio for a chat about cutting that wonderful album, landing on 100.
Keep It 100 was just another way of saying keep it real.
Okay.
You know, which is very popular in the late 80s and 90s. Keep It 100 was the 21st century version of Keep It Real, which is in essence just landing on something that you think is honest or real, or just give me the whole truth. So.
And this is the vibe of the album, I guess. Exactly. This is the vibe that pervades the record.
Exactly, yeah. It just felt like, for me, I was landing on something that was real and honest and truthful.
And how do you get that? The record has such a lovely quality to it. It sounds effortless.
Thank you.
Are you like a swan who glides along but is paddling furiously under the water? And what was the production of that album like?
It was great. It was a very organic process. During the whole 10-year gap, you know, I really wanted to just kind of stay open and live life and not force it, you know. And so I just listened to a lot of the great classics, you know, that really touched me as a kid. And I wanted to bring that feeling, you know, to the 21st century, but have a contemporary energy and a modern conversation behind it. So, yeah, I just opened myself up to all the different ideas and I wound up meeting, you know, other musicians that had the same kind of understanding and musicality and sense of musicality. And then we just kind of, you know, build things organically. I had the songs, the structure already in place, you know, and some ideas of my own, but they contributed a lot of great ideas. And the producer on the album, Patrice Bart Williams and Matthew John, they both brought a lot to the table in terms of production ideas, the strings and other things like that.
And is that a process of literally swapping records and talking about music? Is that where it kind of starts from? When you said that you were hanging out with this group of musicians that ended up on the record, how do you come together with those people? Is it getting people into a room and seeing who sticks when you're riffing, when you're writing stuff, or is it or recording stuff, or is it really about kind of conversations?
It's always a conversation, both with instruments and just sitting around talking about, you know, what the music or what the song needs. By the time I met most of the musicians, as I said, I had most of the ideas in place already. But, you know, we talked about what the music made us feel like. And then once we started that conversation, the guys started, you know, drawing upon influences like, oh, yeah, this is a bit of a Motown thing, or this is kind of an Earth, Wind & Fire thing. Right. And so all those kind of things started to fall in place.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's one of those things which I guess it's a record that you can feel, it's almost timeless. It's got timeless elements to it.
Cool,
what were
you.
Some of the records that you were listening to in the 10 years before you cut the record?
Well, you know, I listened to, you know, a lot of the Motown stuff for sure. Curtis Mayfield, Bill Withers, and then the Motown breakout, you know, Marvin and Stevie, you know, really got off into the lush arrangements that a lot
of because that's where some of those strings maybe come from.
You know, a lot of the Barry White.
Right.
Always love Barry White strings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so, something that, so that's a bit of a funny one. We'll talk about Barry White in brackets for a second. Why is everyone thinks of kind of satin sheets or something. They forget there's a lot of genius behind that stuff.
Oh my
right?
God, amazing music.
Yeah.
He was an amazing composer.
Do these songs mean something different? Do they start to mean something different in your head when you perform them live, when you find little bits that work better live than maybe they did in the studio, especially with a band that I guess that you now are on the road with and are pals with?
Absolutely. You know, you find a deeper way to communicate the songs, you know, the more you play them out live, and, you know, you see people's reaction and how those songs really find people where they live. You know, I can't tell you how many times on this tour, you know, people have come up and actually said, the song really got me through, or this is going to be my song for my wedding.
Right.
You know, different things like that, you know, so it definitely becomes more meaningful.
That was Cody Chestnut, whose new album, Landing on 100, is out now. And fear not, because we will, of course, squeeze in one more track from that great session at the end of the show. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Regular listeners might remember last year I tried to achieve a higher state of consciousness via some art theoretical breathing exercise. Those of the Mazdaznan technique, proposed by Johannes Itten at the beginning of the last century and reignited by British artist Ian Whittlesey, who led me through the exercises. This week, Ian has a new show at London's beautiful Marlborough Contemporary Gallery, and this one, called Becoming Invisible, takes as its cue the literature of Rosicrucianism, theosophy, and esoteric yoga, no less. I think the best thing to do is let the show do the talking. Katie and I headed to Mayfair to see if we'd disappear. Hi, Ian. How's it going? Good to see you again.
Everything in the show generically is called Becoming Invisible, and it's a bit like charades. There's a book, there's a film, there's some paintings, and the starting point for the show is the book, and the book describes how to become invisible. It draws on techniques from Rosicrucianism and theosophy and esoteric yoga, a lot of which I came across when I was doing the research for the Mazdaznan book.
And the Mazdaznan was... one of the riffs on it, one of the ideas was it was a little known fact amongst people that maybe have two facts about Eve Klein at their disposal. But he became a black belt in judo and studied it in order to do his thing.
The connection is sort of at one remove to the Mazdaznan, but it comes back to this one. So the Mazdaznan was more related to Johannes Itten, who taught his students at the Bauhaus the Mazdaznan breathing exercises, which is what we did last time. And as you say, Klein was before he became an artist, he was obsessed by judo and moved to Japan for 2 years and studied and wrote a book on judo published in 1954. And to loop back to this one, Klein was also in his teenage years a Rosicrucian. The modern day Rosicrucians are inevitably based in California, but they still run a mail order business that's slightly like Scientology. You pay them £400 and you sign up, and then you pay more each month for the latest lesson. And Klein took it incredibly seriously between the ages of 17 and 18. I should probably also say that so the video shows all of the Marlborough Gallery's Marlborough Contemporary staff performing the first exercise in the book. And so there was a copy produced for each of the staff. They were given a copy, left to study it, and then we filmed them as they performed the first exercise. The exercises begin by the very first one is one has to be able to visualize the spectrum, the seven colors of the spectrum. And so the first work as you enter in on the right is a small painting of the spectrum. And the book says if you have difficulty visualizing the spectrum, use this page as a reminder before you start the exercises.
So you've got the staff of the gallery here. They're going through the cycle. They're going from purple to indigo to blue.
It was the very first time they did it, so we're just doing one color, and they're doing it's 3 minutes. And what they're actually concentrating on is not only the color but the breathing pattern, which is, as with all esoteric exercises, is very important. So like when we did the Mazdaznan exercises, they're doing a 7-second breathing pattern. So one breathes in for 7 seconds, which is sort of at the limits of how it's comfortable to breathe, holds the breath, and then breathes out. And whilst they're doing that, they're trying to visualize a single color that begins as a soft glow in the room, and the book describes it as if you're looking through a tinted glass. And then the colour gets stronger and stronger and fills the room until you're looking into a field of colour. Shall we have a go?
Yeah, shall we have a go at this? So this is the first exercise. Does this have a name, or is this simply...
No, just the first exercise.
And shall I think of a particular colour in the spectrum?
Red is the first.
So we'll start with red. So I'm going to imagine red. I'm going to get into a red mindset, but I'm going to stare at a white space on the wall, right?
Yeah, so when they perform the exercises, they were sort of about here, and...
And staring over here?
Yeah, that's good. And
so I'm breathing for 7 seconds.
Yeah, but before we begin, you just need to sort of relax. Shoulders back, feet sort of like shoulder width apart, hands by your side. That's it, not tense, and... because you can see in the video, if you start off too tense, you fall over, basically.
So I'm going to concentrate on maybe, like in skiing instruction, bending your knees a little bit, maybe, being loose.
Okay, so I'll read from the text and you do.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so we've done the prelude breaths to empty the lungs of stale air, and it says, then start to breathe with the rhythm that is key to mastering these exercises. Breathe slowly in through your nose, allowing each breath in to take 7 seconds. Then breathe slowly out through your nose, again allowing each exhalation to take 7 seconds. Persist with this breathing pattern until it becomes natural and unforced. Begin to visualize a single color. First, red. Breathe in white and breathe out red. Each time you breathe out, the amount of red in the room will increase. Continue breathing with the 7-second rhythm. Each breath in should fill your body and anchor you to the floor. Each breath out should empty your body and draw you upwards and outwards, filling the room with color. Continue to breathe in white and breathe out red. Allow the color to softly fill the room in front of you. It will at first appear as though you are looking through a tinted glass, and then as you breathe ever more red into the space, the colored mist will slowly solidify until your gaze is filled by red.
Got like an image of a sort of almost like a powdery smoke.
Kind of. That's good.
Yeah.
That's very good.
Yeah. Feels like it's very thick. Yes.
Great. We better stop before you disappear.
Yeah. Okay. I know. I've got to come back. Okay. I think I'm back. That's changed my mood quite a lot. Actually, I feel different.
That's good.
And
it's in some ways it's a purely physiological reaction to hearing the text and breathing in that way. And so the next stage after one can easily produce each of the colors is that you then condense each of the colors to form a cloud, and there's in the show there's a representation of each of the colors as a cloud. And then if we walk up the other end of the gallery past the number 7 painting that signifies the 7 colors of the spectrum.
Is that like a reminder for you as
the
show?
Yes, and so then we reach 3 big paintings which are spray paint on directly onto card. And the first shows the 7 clouds of color, which the book says will tend to naturally form a geometric shape. So once you have control of the color, they will assume this shape in the room. And then you have to consciously draw the clouds of color together, which is what the second painting shows. As they come together, the clouds will form a white cloud, which is what the third painting shows. Once you have the white cloud, you simply step into the white cloud and you become invisible. The book says it's like trying to stare at the sun or a brightly lit bulb. You know it's there, but you can't see it or you can't observe it. So it's not a question of dematerializing or becoming incorporeal. You're still in the room, you just are unobservable.
That was Ian Whittlesey, whose new exhibition, Becoming Invisible, is on at London's Marlborough Contemporary until the 27th of April. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're off to São Paulo after this. Recently, São Paulo hosted its Feira Planner, an event that promotes the magazine and independent publishing scene in the city. Brazil has a rich history of underground publishing after many political dissidents were kept silent in the 2 decades of military dictatorship that ruled the country. Then creating their own pamphlets was the only way to spread their ideas. But now, in the digital age, where information and ideas are ubiquitous and accessible, Brazil's revived independent publishing scene has a fresh face. Monocle correspondent Sheena Rossiter went to Feira Planner and sent us this report.
Crowds of Generation Y Paulistanos elbow their way through the shoulder-to-shoulder crowd at São Paulo's Museum of Image and Sound, better known quite simply as MIS. Sounds of a buzzing crowd echo that of a packed music festival. But no, this horde of people is here for a more silent art form, independent design and literature at the Feira Planner event.
A primeira coisa foi fazer projeto.
Bia Bittencourt is the creator, curator and organizer of the event. She explains how she got the idea.
Eu sempre fui muito apaixonada por livros.
I've always loved books. I wanted to buy artistic books when I was young.
I was always going to smaller publishing houses or small stores that sold books from abroad. So I created this idea in my head that I needed to have a bookstore. But then I became an adult and realized that in the real world, it's much harder to make my own books. Then I started to meet a lot of people who make their own publications and sell them online. I went to the New York Art Book Fair last year, and I came back to Sao Paulo with this fixed idea in my head about what I wanted to do.
After many long nights and plenty of hard work, Feira Plana was born. And Bia is clearly not the only 20-something in Sao Paulo with a love for zines. She has tailored Feira Plana for her generation. She tells us about the curious crowd here.
The people that come to the fair aren't exactly the same as those who go to a bookstore to buy 50 Shades of Grey. It's a different group of people who like art, they like to design. It's a place with a different beat.
Combo editions. You can be an editor, a curator, or a collector.
Bruno Mendoza is one of the independent zine creators that Bia selected to be part of Feira Plana. He is selling and displaying his printed artworks here today as part of the Mobile Archive Project. Bruno says that Brazil actually has a longer history with zines that strengthened during more repressive times.
What happened is that in the 60s and in the 70s, we had in Brazil a very powerful kind of production with independent publications and artists making books, but more as a political kind of thing, something that you can spread around the system like a virus. It was more as this idea of dissemination and working in a kind of web kind of thinking.
Bruno, who is only 29 years old himself, says that, in a way, independent production has come full circle in a new generation that lives in a very different Brazil.
What is happening here today is that there is a generation of the beginning of the 2000 that are producing a very powerful kind of work in this way. Paper today is a kind of fetish because of the digital culture. And I think that there are a lot of young people that are buying this, that I call them the Tumblr generation. So they have a kind of a specific eye for this kind of artwork. I think they really connect with this kind of production.
Nossa, eu tô super impressionado que eu cheguei hoje, meio-dia aqui, já tava lotadíssimo de gente.
That's Thomas Carvalho, editor-in-chief of Amarelo, a contemporary culture magazine that started 3 years ago here in Sao Paulo. He's blown away by the amount of people here at Feira Plana. By midday, Amarelo had already sold over 400 copies of the magazine, so much that one of his colleagues had to go back to the office to get more. Even though Amarelo does have nationwide circulation, in the dying age of print, it's a major challenge to sell copies of the magazine. For him, this is a victory for the contemporary scene.
I'm really happy with the results here today, because it's been a bit of a fight. We are presenting a different type of literary project, but I'm overwhelmed and very happy, and I hope that this independent literary fair has a long life.
Each edition of his trimestral magazine focuses on a specific subject. He tells more about his publication and this edition's theme, a fitting one for the public here.
This edition looks at the theme of the future. We focus on cities, especially Sao Paulo, and discuss how we're going to live here. I think that there's a big problem with urban planning. There's a bad distribution of public transportation. So we question this a lot in the latest edition. What can we do to create a less stressful future compared to today in Sao Paulo?
It's closing time here at Mies, and it seems like an after party is in order. None of the Feira Plana goers want to leave. Of course, with only two of the around 80 exhibitors here being from outside Brazil, Rojo hailing from Barcelona and JRP Reyinger from Zurich, the fair was hardly international. But after the overflowing success from Bia Bittencourt's first attempt at an art book fair, it's likely to get more funding to have an international voice. This is looking to become an annual event. Regardless, The turnout here proves that there is still a desire for print in a generation old enough to appreciate physical books, but young enough to be savvy to the ways of the web. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thank you, Sheena, and that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be exploring London's most interesting new theatre space and meeting the director behind a film all about the charming inner workings of Radio France. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bulbauer, and Holly Fisher mixed it all together in a magic audio spell. Time for one final song this week from his Midori House session. This is Cody Chesnutt with That's Still Mama. Thank you for tuning in.
Woo, yeah. Church boy, school boy, dope boy, loaded down with attitude like 20 pair of shoes. Who you gonna call now when the lawyer call your name, mama? And when you're standing in front of the state looking all ashamed, yo mama. Church boy, school boy, dope boy, got a backpack full of time and you don't know why you don't even respect the uncles and the lady that sacrificed the birth. Yep. No matter how you feel, your blood's on the seal, can't just treat her anyway. Yeah, that's still mama, that's still mama. Let the recognition show, that's still mama. Church boy, school boy, dope boy, sagging round with an assault charge on your name. Only reason I make this song's because I love you, love you. Only reason I take the time because I don't want to bury him. Church boy, school boy, dope boy, dope boy, I ain't gonna throw my hands up, I'ma love you. I know times can get hard, but being hard ain't gonna get the weight off and rid the scars. No matter how you feel, your blood's on the seal now, can't just treat her anyway. Loss is his deal, that's still mama, that's still mama. Let the recognition show, that's still mama. Church boy, school boy, dope boy, dope boy. Church boy, church boy, school boy, dope boy, dope boy. I'm on fire and I do it cause I love you. I do it cause I love you. I do it cause I love you. I do it, I do it, I do it, I do it cause I love you. Do it cause I love you. I do it cause I love you. Do it, do it, woo. Once a baby had to clean your backside, when you couldn't feed yourself, couldn't clean your eyes. How on earth did you get so beside yourself and abuse the queen that did it all? Boy, you're confused. No matter how you feel, your blood's on the seal now. You can't just treat her any way. No, yeah. That's still mama. That's still mama. Let the recognition show. I remember mama. Mama, I remember mama. Said I remember mama, mama. Said I remember her loving guidance.
Thank you. Thank you so much.